Welcome, friends. Welcome back to ArtCast. Hey, I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, bringing you more architecture information, and have we got a doozy today. You know, about 3 weeks ago, I got an email from Chaz who wrote, "Great show, man. How about a series of talks on architecting a multi-threaded application? With multi-core processors, the rage, this is going to become more and more important." You know what, Chaz? I agree. And so I went out and found the smartest multi-threading guy I could find. I searched high and low, and I asked all around here on the Microsoft campus, who's a really great multi-threading guy that we ought to get involved? Well, you know what? The answer came back, and it was loud and clear. There is one guy who knows this stuff inside out. He writes a column called Concurrent Affair for MSDN Magazine. He's written numerous books on threading and CLR architecture. Let's give it up for Jeff Richter. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today, and welcome to ArtCast.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell the audience a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and that sort of thing.
Well, I'm Jeff Richter, and I'm a co-founder of this company called Wintellect. We do training and consulting and debugging services for people. Wintellect.com is a website. I've been focused heavily on threading since Windows NT 3.1 was in alpha, so like 1991 or so. I have a few Win32 books, which had several chapters on it, on threading and doing thread synchronization and concurrency. And then have a couple of .NET books. The most recent one came out in February 2006. And it had two chapters in there on threading and concurrent programming. And now I write, as you mentioned, this column for MSDN Magazine called Concurrent Affairs, which is all about threading and how to take advantage of hyper-threaded CPUs, multi-core CPUs, and just how to write efficient, scalable, responsive applications.
Wow. So, you know, looking back on this, I can remember the first time I did, you know, a multi-threaded thing, you know, and I thought how cool that was. And, of course, this was years ago when you had to do it in C++. You know, at the time, it was kind of like I crossed a line into the realm of the multi-threaded guru gods of programming. Of course, I wasn't even close to that, right? And pretty soon I found out that it's real easy to get in trouble with threads. And so now with .NET, we made it really accessible for a lot of people who maybe had never written C++ code. Now we've made it so like anybody does VB.NET, anybody C#, any language that you do .NET, now you can fire up a thread. So we have this great new power, but it's like a loaded gun, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it sure is. and there's no end of the number of customers that I work with where I look at some of the threading architectures they put into their application, and I'm just astonished at some of the things that I see there. People are there's one of two minds. Either one mind is they've just heard that threading can really get them in trouble, and so they avoid it like the plague, so they never do anything with it ever, in which case they lose responsiveness in their application, they lose scalability, they won't take advantage of multi-core processors and things when they come out in the future. Or other people say, well, we just know we have to use threads, and then they start using threads for everything. And then you see a thread created here and a thread created there, and they just create them all over the place, and then they run into problems where they have to synchronize between the threads, and it becomes a major headache for them with race conditions, data getting corrupted, they don't know why, and it's just amazing. The two sides of the spectrum are really quite extreme from one another.
So let's just back up for a second, because we're kind of assuming that everybody knows what we're talking about with threading. Okay, so let's begin with some basics. And one of the basics I want to ask you about, of course, is this new thing we're hearing about called multi-core processors. And what is that, and how does it impact this?
Well, so the CPU manufacturers today, like Intel and AMD, they are not able to create chips where it used to be that when they created CPUs, every year and a half, the speed of the CPU would double in following Moore's law. And if you notice over the past couple years, CPU speeds have not increased at the same rate that they used to. It's just not like to keep the heat down and things like that, it's just not possible for them to create those chips at on those trajectories that they were on before. So what they are instead able to do is they're instead able to give us multiple CPUs that are, well, slow or at today's speeds without the speeds getting any faster. So just recently, like within the past year, dual core processors started shipping, which is a single CPU chip or single chip, but it has two real CPUs on it. each with their own separate cache. And so now, and they tend to be around 3 gigahertz or so in speed, so they're not particularly fast, not what you might expect, because 3 gigahertz have been around for a long time now. But you have two processors, and the only way you can take advantage of those in the computer is if you have at least two threads capable of doing work.
Okay, so now let's talk about what a thread is.
Okay. A thread is kind of the virtualization of a processor. And if you go back to the early operating systems, like even, you know, DOS and 16-bit Windows, they were single-threaded operating systems. If an application went into an infinite loop, the whole operating system hung. All the applications on it, the operating system itself. I mean, I can still remember back in the Windows 2.0 days where an application would enter an infinite loop, and then if you move the mouse on your desk, the mouse cursor would no longer move on your screen. Of course, end users don't like that. They want the operating system to be more robust and responsive to that. So should one application go into an infinite loop, then the rest of the operating system continues to run and the other programs would continue to run, and ideally they could just kill the application that's no longer responding, which of course Windows NT was the first operating system from Microsoft that supported this concept of multiple threads. So the whole reason why threads were added to the system was to create responsiveness and more reliability. If one application went into an infinite loop, the operating system still responded to hardware events like mouse movements and keystrokes, and the user could use other applications, and then they could go kill the application that entered an infinite loop. Now, another benefit that we got with the first version of Windows NT was that it was supported symmetric multiprocessing machines. These are computers that had multiple physical CPU chips in them. In fact, one company had a computer where you could put 32 processors inside that one machine. And Windows NT was able to schedule one thread per processor. And on a 32 processor machine, that means you could get 32 things executing concurrently. So the time it would take you to get one thing done, you could get 32 things done theoretically, assuming there was no sharing of resources between them.
Okay, so the way I kind of picture this is like a CPU, I get a visual image in my mind, like a CPU is like a worker at a desk, right? Okay. And you can only deal with, maybe it's like the customer service desk, right? You can only deal with one customer at a time, right? And so now there's one line, and in the old days, there was only one line, single threaded, right? And if one customer got there and tied up the whole line forever, nothing got done. So then it was like, okay, well, let's have multiple lines. And even though there's only one customer service rep, maybe one CPU in the machine, what he does is he kind of serves line one, and then he switches over to line two, and then switches over to line three, kind of moving around between the lines. Is that a good picture?
Yeah, it's a reasonably good picture. But one thing to consider when that happens is that there's overhead involved. Mm-hmm. So when you're switching from, when the customer service person is switching from line one to line two to line three, we would call that a context switch.
Right.
In Windows NT, they happen about every 20 milliseconds or so. Or Windows XP now, they happen every 20 milliseconds or so. And there's overhead involved in that switch. And it actually causes performance of getting the task done to degrade. So if you have lots of threads available in the system, the operating system spends a lot of time context switching between them, which actually slows the performance of getting the work done. And we're willing to pay this cost of having worse performance in order to have better reliability and responsiveness.
Yeah, and so that kind of attacks one of the myths of threading that you often heard is that, oh, well, we've got multiple threads, our app's going to be faster, which it not necessarily is. It might appear more responsive, but it might actually take longer because it's switching amongst threads.
Almost definitely. Plus the overhead that you'll have to write into your code to do the orchestration between the multiple threads, because eventually you're spawning a thread to get some other work done and keep some other thread doing something else. But presumably at some point you need to orchestrate or coordinate the results of that back together. And you have to write that additional code, it's error-prone code, and it has to execute, which actually makes it slower. And so in many cases, people are better off just keeping it on a single thread.
Okay, so let's talk about one of the other things, the ever-dreaded race condition. Now, a lot of times people have thrown this term around, but I'm not sure everybody knows what it means. What is a race condition?
A race condition is when two or more threads are going to hit some resource, like a data object, and it happens to be at the exact same time. and or you think it's going to happen that this one's going to hit it first and the other one's going to hit it second, but they're really both racing for it, and because Windows is a preemptive operating system, you don't know really which one's going to hit it first. So they're both racing.
So the downside of this is that when you're just sitting there developing your code, you kind of assume a certain order things are going to happen, right? And in a single-threaded world, you can definitely count on they're happening in a certain order. But in a multi-threaded world, you always have that sort of uncertainty. This might happen before that, and if it does, what's the impact? And what I have found in working with debugging a lot of these kind of problems is that they're the kind of problem that shows up once in a great while, and the app behaves weirdly. And, you know, you could run it 1,000 times on your developer workstation. It's perfect every time. And then you put it on a different machine or a lab machine or on the customer side, and boom, the thing blows up because of a race condition.
That's absolutely true. You're more likely to see them on a multiprocessor machine versus a single processor machine, because on a single processor machine, really, only one thread is running at a time. But on dual core or hyper-threaded machine or a dual processor machine, you're much more likely to see it. Another thing that could happen because of it is a deadlock situation where all of a sudden one thread just seems to stop and it's just stuck. Then usually the end user does have to go to something like Task Manager and kill the process to get control back.
Yeah, so we see this a lot of times. You know, when I used to be on the Complus team, we would get a customer situation and we'd ask for process dumps and things like that. And that's what we would do. We'd look over the threads. We'd look for, you know, a thread which is stuck for some reason, and then, you know, try to figure out what led up to that weird kind of situation. And so, knowing that these things are going to happen, we have threads that are working. Sometimes they need to access the same resource. Sometimes we want a thread to wait until that resource is available. These are the things we often refer to just generally as thread synchronization issues. What are the ways that that people get threads to do what they want in terms of synchronization?
Well, there's lots of locking mechanisms that ship as either part of Windows or part of the .NET framework that programmers can take advantage of. It is a complex thing to do, and a lot of times I've written a lot of multi-threading code over the past, well, more than a decade now, and I'll write a bunch of code and I'll think it's absolutely perfect, and I'll even maybe code review it with some people and they'll think, yes, it looks absolutely perfect, and then sometime down the line you find out there's a race condition in it and it deadlocks something. That can just happen. So it's going to require a lot of experience, and it's really going to require a lot of testing to do it. And you want to try to do it in as small of area as possible. And another thing that people don't generally consider is that thread synchronization is a performance hit. In some cases, it can be quite significant. In fact, in many cases, the NT team has found that the overhead of entering a lock is sometimes more performance costly than the code that you execute while you hold the lock inside the thread. So in some cases, the performance is eaten up entirely by the locks, not by the actual work you're trying to get done. And building something that's high performance and scalable, the more locks you have, the worse the performance will actually get. Aside from the fact, of course, that by having a lot of locks, you're only allowing one thread at a time to access those resources, and that also hurts performance a lot too. So again, this is going to make it sound like you should avoid threads and thread synchronization. But to a large extent, I believe that people should avoid it as much as possible because it is error prone. That being said, though, what I do think people are not doing, which they should be doing much more of, is asynchronous I/O. And I'd like to turn the discussion more in that direction because I think it's actually more usable, less error prone, and I think people will get a bigger bang for the buck with that.
Okay, so let's back up for a second and think about some scenarios. Okay, one of the I kind of break it down into sort of server scenarios and client scenarios, right? So let's deal with server scenarios first, right? So you're thinking about web services, maybe ASP.NET pages, maybe Windows Communication Foundation services eventually, even things like .NET remoting and so forth. In these server infrastructures that Microsoft builds to support these things, they are already taking advantages of threads and thread pools and all that kind of thing. So if I think, wow, I want my ASP.NET page to be faster, maybe I'm going to launch some threads from my page code so that I can do something concurrently. Is that a good idea?
No. That is not a good idea.
Why not?
Well, for basically a bunch of the reasons we kind of enumerated is that creating threads are not free resources. Each one has a megabyte of stack, so it's, you are allocating 1 megabyte of virtual address space every time you create a thread, plus another 12K of kernel mode, because there's a kernel mode stack for every thread, plus there's a thread kernel object. And in Windows, the creation and destruction of a thread, there is a lot of work that Windows has to do just to create it. For example, every dynamic link library in the process gets a thread attach notification, and every DLL gets a thread detach notification when the thread dies. It's quite common today for a single process to have 100 dynamic link libraries in it, which means when you create a thread, you're calling 100 functions first before the thread's allowed to do the what you created it for. And then when it dies, it calls 100 functions before the thread is allowed to die. So while a lot cheaper than creating a process, creating a thread is still a pretty expensive thing, and it really hurts performance a lot. Add on to that, the coordination, because you're creating this thread to do some work for you while your thread does something else, you need to coordinate the results of that. So now you're creating probably additional kernel objects like events to do that coordination and detect when the other thing is done, and you're really just making your life hell.
Okay, so the expense of creating and releasing threads is one of the reasons why people come up with thread pools as a way to avoid that. Now, of course, I probably don't want to build my own thread pool, but .NET has one I can use, right?
Yes, it does. So the idea behind a thread pool is that it is a that there are pieces of code inside a process, and periodically you want to do things asynchronously on some other thread. So rather than create a thread and destroy a thread each time you want to do that, a thread pool will create them on demand, and then it tends to reuse the same thread repeatedly. So initially the thread pool in the CLR has no threads in it. And when you ask the thread pool to do something, it will create a very first thread. That comes with a performance hit and stack gets allocated and so on. Then it goes and does the work. But instead of when the work's completed, the thread dying, the thread goes back to the pool where it sits idle, ready to handle some other request. So if the next time you queue up something and ask it to do some work, the CLR thread pool just uses the existing thread, so it doesn't create a new one, and says, all right, I'm just going to reuse that one. And it just keeps reusing it over and over and over again. Now, if you're putting a heavy workload on the thread pool and the one thread can't seem to satisfy it, then it will go and create additional threads. But the CLR thread pool does that dynamically, and it's monitoring how long your tasks are taking and how many tasks you're queuing up, and it has an algorithm to figure out that it should be creating more threads. Then let's say you've put a lot of work on the thread pool, it's created a ton of threads, and then you've stopped putting work on the thread pool, like maybe it's midnight and your server's not being hit with client requests anymore. So now you have a bunch of threads that are created in your process, but they're not doing any work because no requests are coming in. In that case, our thread pool's smart enough to wake up some of those threads and kill them. So now it's reclaiming those resources. So in other words, the thread pool will dynamically adjust itself depending on the workload your application's putting on it. And that's nice that programmers don't have to write that themselves and that this facility is built into the common language runtime. And also in Windows 2000, in the Win32 API, there's a thread pool APIs in there as well.
So if I think about taking advantage of a thread pool, what I'm really thinking about doing is creating a chunk of work that could be done kind of very independently whenever the thread pool gets around to it, and I queue that work with queue user work item or something like that.
Yeah, threadpool.queue user work item.
Right, and so I can just say, okay, well, thread pool, get to this whenever you can, and it will get to it. But in that kind of light, I'm thinking I can just let it get to it whenever it can, and I'm not going to like wait until I know it got to it or things like that. I have to be a little more flexible.
That's right.
Now, the other thing, though, is, I mean, of course, in these server-side infrastructures, especially in the .NET code, the .NET infrastructure itself is using threads from the CLR thread pool, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So if I'm grabbing threads out of the pool, I'm kind of competing with the infrastructure, say like ASP.NET, for example. I'm competing with it for threads, so I might actually be slowing the whole thing down more than helping it.
No, that's not the right way to think about it.
Oh, okay.
Presumably, you're using a thread to execute some short-lived task, not something that's going to go on for a long period of time. And in fact, if you look at something like Task Manager and you look at the CPU usage on your machine, most people's CPUs are maybe being used 10% of the time, and the other 90% they're not doing anything. So that means that of every 1 second, 10% of that 1 second of time, the computer is actually doing something useful. Most of the time our computers are sitting idle. So in ASP or any kind of server application, a thread from the thread pool wakes up, does a little bit of work, and then it goes back into the thread pool ready to do something else. So when you're queuing up tasks for the thread pool, and if the infrastructure is queuing up tasks for the thread pool, then you're all just queuing up these little short-lived tasks, and really one thread will probably be used to handle all of those tasks.
Oh, okay.
And so very few threads end up being created. Because there's only one thread, there's no context switching that has to occur. So the operating system overhead of every 20 milliseconds switching to another thread doesn't have to happen. And so you end up getting the work done actually much quicker with just one thread, using less resources. And the programming model is simpler, because it's easy to say threadpool.queue or work item. It's much harder to say new up a thread, here's my callback function, then start the thread, then join to it to find out when it's done. I mean, that's a lot more lines of code. Plus, there's all the overhead of creating the thread, all the resources, calling the DLL functions, letting it execute, having the DLL functions called again, then having the thread die. Using the thread pool is one line of code, much faster, more efficient.
Okay, so in the queue user work item thread pool model, what kind of guidelines do I need to think about the work that I'm going to do? You said relatively short-lived.
You probably don't need the thread to be in any particular state. For example, it's best, Windows does support scheduling threads with priorities, and all the thread pool threads are normal priority. If you feel that you need to create a thread that's high priority or low priority, you're probably better off creating your own thread explicitly rather than using a thread pool thread. If you need some other special state associated with the thread, like maybe a security context, or maybe special culture information, then you might be better off creating your own thread rather than using a thread pool thread. If you want to abort the thread, which is a feature the CLR supports, the ability to take a thread and have it go do something, but then you decide you want it to stop doing that halfway through so that we have the ability to abort, it's probably better to do that with a dedicated thread rather than to use a thread pool thread. But these are generally edge cases, and it is very rare that somebody would need to go and create a thread for any of these scenarios.
So, let's imagine then. Let's take an example of a long-running operation. Let's say on my ASP.NET page, I need to call a web service that goes off to the mainframe or something, and this thing is, it could be fast, but it might be really, really slow. Now, so I could launch a thread and do all that stuff myself, but we already said that's a bad idea. I could do queue user work item as one way to do it and kind of queue that work. And then make the call. But you mentioned also async I/O is maybe a better way to go.
So without question, asynchronous I/O is the best way to go. So with asynchronous I/O, your thread from the thread pool would wake up because a client request came in. The thread would start to do some work. Then it would initiate the web service request or maybe database request. After it initiates that request, then the thread goes back to the thread pool. Now, the server, web server or database server, is doing whatever work you requested of it, and eventually it'll get around to responding with the result. It could be a fraction of a second, it could be several minutes from now, we don't know, but we don't care. And what's really cool about the way Windows is architected in the kernel, the operating system kernel, is that you're using no operating system resources, no thread or anything, in order to wait for these IOs to complete. That's beautiful. And when the result eventually does come back in, which would come into the network card, since the web services and database comes in over the network, versus, let's say, file I/O, which would come in over the disk device driver, then the device driver goes and notifies your application, hey, that data finally came back in. And it does that by posting a work item into the CLR thread pool. So now, some CLR thread pool thread will eventually wake up, just like with everything else it does, and will call some method that you write back, and this method is being called because the I/O finally came in. So the goal of, and then you do the processing of the I/O, and then you can return the result back to the ultimate client. The beautiful thing about this is that you don't have a thread that is sitting idle for any period of time. And that thread gets to be reused. Having a thread sitting waiting for I/O is just a terrible thing. A thread's a terrible thing to waste.
Okay.
Right? Again, because it has resources and scheduling impact and all kinds of things like that the operating system has to consider. So you should really try to avoid having threads block for any period of time. And I/O in particular, you should not have threads block for, because Windows has this infrastructure to do it asynchronously.
So when I want to make that async call, there's this async pattern in .NET where I go, you know, my service dot begin invoke,
right,
and then at some later point I'm going to get a callback on the delegate that I gave it, and you know, and all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like you're saying, you know, there's probably no reason why I shouldn't just do it that way.
In an ideal world, you should definitely do it that way. The only reason why people sometimes do not do it that way, well, there's two reasons. One is the programming is harder.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of programmers don't think, well, in this method, I'll write the code to initiate the request, and then the code to get the response, I have to write that as a separate function. But we are starting to get features in our programming languages, because that's purely a syntactical inconvenience. But we are now getting features in our programming languages to make this less of an inconvenience. For example, C# has this anonymous method feature where you can call a begin method, and then for the callback code that you want to execute, rather than write that as a separate function and give the name of the method there, you can just put that code directly in line. So you're writing your code sequentially again. C# also has this iterator feature that is kind of a state machine where you can say, well, let me call this begin method, and then you could do a yield return, and then you could say, well, here's the code that does the follow-up. What happens when that completes? And you're writing it all in one method now. Syntactically, you're writing it all in one method, but the compiler is breaking it up for you automatically. And I think we're going to see more features added to programming languages to make this so it's less obvious to programmers. But asynchronous I/O will actually be happening, but it will be, you'll be writing your code so it looks sequential.
And you would do the async I/O with the database calls also?
Oh, I'd do it any time of I/O.
Yeah.
Any kind of I/O.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that sounds like it makes a lot of sense to approach that way. Let's think about on the client side scenario, because one of the typical ways people have done this is to avoid the app that's not responsive, right? So my app, somebody clicks a button, I'm going to go off and call a web service or a long-running database thing, and my app just kind of freezes there. People get ticked off, kill it in Task Manager, stuff like that happens.
I've seen it many times.
Right. So and now there was a new thing introduced in .NET 2.0 to kind of help make this easier with this this background thing, thread thing. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the event-based asynchronous programming model. This event-based APM was a pattern that was created by people on the Windows Forms team here at Microsoft. And their goal was to create a programming model that made it easier for programmers to do asynchronous operations. Well, that was the main goal of it.
Mm-hmm.
I personally have some problems with the pattern because asynchronous programming easier, but it's not a very efficient pattern. It creates a lot of additional objects because it's all event-based. Events are wrapped around delegates. So it's not for doing high performance and scalable work. It's to make your programming life easier and getting some asynchronous I/O into your application. Also, there are actually very few classes in the .NET framework that actually support this pattern. I actually did a look at it once, and there's about, I don't know, so, that implement this. But some of the lower-level classes, like streams, do not offer this pattern. So it can only be used in certain scenarios.
Okay, so, but really, if we just do the async I/O from the client side, we'd have the same thing, right? I mean, and one of the main reasons why people do this background thread on the UI is just to keep the app responsive while some kind of I/O is going on. And you're just saying, well, duh, let's just do the async I/O from the get-go.
Yes, no question in my mind. And that's what Internet Explorer does. That's what Media Player does. It's what Media Center does. It's what the new Vista Explorer shell does. All these, like, for let's take Internet Explorer for an example, which is a client-side application. When you go to Internet Explorer and you surf to some web page, which brings down a bunch of HTML, inside that HTML there can be image tags for images. So now the browser has to go back to those servers and get those images. Well, it does that all asynchronously because you, and it shows you the page right away, and then the pictures come in and they fill in the page as they come back from the various servers. But if you, the end user, maybe read some text, you don't care anymore, you want to surf to another page, the UI in Internet Explorer stays very responsive through all of that. And what they're doing underneath the covers, now it's not written in managed code, but they're taking advantage of the asynchronous I/O that Windows supports in the kernel, and they're issuing these image requests. They issue them all at once. If there's five images on a page, they go to those five different servers and say, get me this image, get me this image, get me this image, get me this image. And then they return their thread back to the message loop so it's responsive to the UI. As the servers return back the images, a thread in Internet Explorer wakes up, says, oh, that image came in. And by the way, when it issues those five, it doesn't know which one's going to come back first because they can come out in random order, but it doesn't matter. And when it comes back in, it says, oh, this one came in, and then it updates the user interface on the fly. And it all stays very responsive due to that. Another cool feature about this is that let's say you wanted to get five images from five different servers. And let's say that it takes you 5 seconds to get each one of those. If you do that using synchronous I/O, then you issue the first one, you wait for the response, then you issue the second request, you wait for the response, you do it for the third, the fourth, the fifth, and it ends up being 5 times 5 seconds or 25 seconds for you to populate your complete user interface. But if you issue those five requests all asynchronously, you issue them all, that's immediate, and then they all come back to you, you will update your whole user interface in just 5 seconds instead of 25 seconds. So your app stays responsive, you're using typically one thread to do everything, maybe two, and it takes less time to show the end result to the user than doing synchronous I/O.
Yes, I think there's a lot of potential there. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean,
I've talked myself into it completely.
You know, and I see there's, you know, a lot of apps that I use that, you know, the UI kind of remains responsive, and then you notice some part of the UI kind of catching up with the work you're doing, and yeah. And you're going to kind of says, oh, well, maybe that was an async I/O, or in the case of a lot of the audio and video processing software I use, I'm sure they're doing a background thread to do a lot of the processing work that's actually CPU number crunching kind of work, because you know it's having to calculate graphs of stuff and it's displaying all that on from a background thread. So that sounds like kind of legitimate background thread work. I mean, if you're going to do something on a background thread, it ought to be something that's really, you know, doing CPU stuff rather than just waiting on I/O.
I don't know.
He's hesitating.
Yes, I'm hesitating.
If you want to keep your user interface responsive and you have some compute-bound work to do versus I/O-bound work, then doing the compute-bound work on another thread might be a good thing to do. Because then your main thread that manages the UI stays dedicated to being responsive on the UI, and then you have this other thread that's doing the compute-bound work in the background. You might even want to lower the priority of that compute-bound thread to make sure that the UI really stays responsive, but then you do have the coordination headaches of updating. And of course, Windows is a single-threaded GUI system. So anytime if the background thread wants to update something in the user interface, it does have to marshal that into the message queue so that the GUI thread can wake up and go and actually update the user interface itself. So then you introduce these coordination issues.
So it's, you know, and one of the interesting things, a number of years ago, I did a talk about exception handling at TechEd. Mm-hmm. And at the first TechEd I did, I had somebody come up afterwards and ask me about, well, what about exceptions and threads, you know? And so I didn't really address it. So I went off before the next one. I researched this whole thing, and it was kind of, I hadn't really thought about it. But it turns out, like, if you get an exception on a background thread, your thread will just die. It will just go poof, you know? And your main thread might not even know. So if you have kind of this coordination thing going on, and your main thread is waiting on the background thread to do something, and it has an exception, and it just dies, then your main thread is sitting there kind of waiting forever for something that's never going to happen. And you get all kinds of weird things like that, so you have to come up with these sort of protocols of communication between the background threads and the main threads so that in the event of exceptions or other things that are going on, you've got to synchronize those. I guess the whole point of that story is I wouldn't take this step lightly.
Well, let me say the scenario you just described was true for the Common Language Runtime version 1.0 or 1.1.
Oh, okay.
But in version 2 of the CLR team modified it so that when any thread gets an unhandled exception, we now kill the whole process.
Oh, okay.
Because of the exact scenario you just described, where one thread spawned up some other thread to do some work, that thread died, and now the main thread waited forever for that to complete.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the CLR team was wrong in the first two versions. There's no question now, which is why they changed it. And it's kind of, well, silly to me that they did it that way, because Windows has always had the policy that any thread in the process gets an unhandled exception, the whole process terminates. So why the CLR team in versions 1.0.1.1 didn't follow that pattern, well, we don't know, but they fixed it in 2.0.
Okay. Okay, so I guess, you know, I'm trying to think as we kind of wrap up here, you know, and this show is really primarily for architects rather than devs, although today's kind of had a lot of lower-level thinking. But I think a lot of times architects get devs coming to them saying, oh, we're going to, like, you know, roll up a bunch of threads here, and we're going to spin up these things, and we're going to get all kinds of work done. I guess we have to be thinking very, very carefully about the scenarios where that's appropriate. And it sounds like to me there's very, very few of them. And if you did want to take that leap, you better be prepared for a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I would say there's almost no reason for somebody to go and create a thread themselves. The thread pool is much goodness. It will improve over time, and any application that uses it will reap those benefits as time goes on. So I would not be creating any threads yourself. I would be using the thread pool, and I would really try to do as much I/O asynchronously as possible in order to gain the scalability and responsiveness.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for giving me your insight on threading.
My pleasure.
All right. Jeff Richter, ladies and gentlemen. Multi-threaded guy. I think he's got a lot of threads going on in that amazing mind of his, and what a smart guy he is, too. You know, that didn't turn out the way you expected, did it? You know, because you thought he was going to come in here and be like, oh, yeah, launch a thread for this, launch a thread for that. And basically, I think we came to the conclusion at the end, asynchronous I/O is the way to go. And threading is kind of a very special, difficult technique that you need to think very carefully about before you dive in and use it. And if you do, use that thread pool. Man, that's the way to go. Okay, so we got it? We got it. Hey, we'll see you next time here on ArtCast.